23. At a few minutes after one, Gideon stood in front of the small gated courtyard of the Museo de Curiosidades. The gate was closed and latched, but the padlock had been removed. He lifted the latch and entered the courtyard. Once it had probably been a graceful patio, rich with plants and perhaps a welcoming fountain. Now it looked like the entrance to a junk shop, all weeds, cracked cement paving, and junk. On second glance, however, the junk proved to be exhibits, each with a small, faded, foxed, meticulously hand-lettered placard in English and Spanish. To the left of the big oak door of the casa itself was a weathered concrete bust of Kaiser Wilhelm I, complete with spiked helmet. From the residence of Friedrich Fliegholz, German ambassador to Mexico, 1883 to 1886. To the right was the sacred throne of Axayácatl, emperor of the Aztecs, an ugly hunk of basalt that an imaginative mind might have construed as being shaped more or less like a chair. Further along, attached to the casa's wall by a chain, was a wooden Chinese empress's bench. If these were the guy's come-on exhibits, Gideon thought, it was no wonder he doesn't seem to be getting much in the way of visitors. Beside the door was a sign in English and Spanish that informed visitors that the entrance fee was 30 pesos and instructed them to ring the bell. Gideon did, and the door swung open to reveal a vestibule in which the man they'd seen yesterday sat at an old office desk, clacking away at a many-carboned document on an ancient upright manual Remington typewriter. Sir Henry Castellanos Jones, said the nameplate at the front of the desk. Yes, he said, not pleased to be interrupted. He was wearing the same rusty suit, the same narrow black tie that he'd worn yesterday. Even sitting down, he had the suit jacket tightly buttoned. I'd like to see the museum. It's 30 pesos, I have no change. That's fine. Seeing no receptacle, he laid the bills on the desk. Would you like me to give you a tour? The fee is 200 pesos. No thanks. I'd just like to wander if that's all right. The choice is yours, but a tour would add a great deal to your visit. No thanks. The man's thin lips turned down. Very well. Please start in the room to your left, the drawing room, and continue around. That is the established pattern for the traffic flow. He returned his attention to his typing. Gideon did as he was told, although he could see from the empty rooms ahead that traffic flow wasn't going to be a problem. The place was much as Sandoval had led him to expect, reeking of mildew and mold, probably from the old upholstered furniture and grungy carpets that appeared to be leftovers from the last person to reside there. The plastered walls were cracked and dirty, the ceilings water-stained and sagging, lit mostly with low-wattage Tiffany-style lamps in various shades of brown. It was like walking around under a mushroom or inside a mausoleum. Most of the exhibits, and there were many, were on dark Victorian-era tables, were in glass-fronted bookcases, and whatever else Gideon might say about them, he was ready to admit that it was the most eclectic and idiosyncratic museum he'd ever been in. The shrunken heads, actually goatskin fakes, that Sandoval had told him about were there, and the Aztec stone knives, knockoffs, and poorly done at that, as well. There was also the withered brown arm and hand of the assassin Pedro Mendoza, who killed beloved Governor Ocampo in 1901. This event rated an entire display case for itself. Along with the arm was the governor's ruffled shirt, complete with holes and blood, and the dagger that did the deed. In general, though, the exhibits were more pedestrian, if no less odd. A letter cancellation machine made in 1848, in use until 4/4/1911. A metal hamburger mold, circa 1931. An 1860 Ashley Archimedean egg beater. If there was a pattern to the displays, Gideon couldn't make it out. The egg beater shared a case with a Czechoslovakian machine pistol from the Great War. The hamburger mold was housed with a porthole from a sunken ship and a crystal ball used in crystal gazing late 1800s. His query, was in a glass-fronted case in the second room he came to, the former dining room, on a shelf shared with a baby shark and a mason jar and a three-masted schooner made of matchsticks. It was only the skull, no mandible, and it rested in a saucer filled with straw. The legend beside it said, "Sacrificed Zapotec Princess, 1,000 years old." Gideon had to kneel to look it in the eye, so to speak, and even when he did, there wasn't much he could tell about it. It was male, not female. The supraorbital ridges and robust mastoid processes told him that much. There were streaks of green, blue, and red color here and there, probably the remnants of the colored candles that had once been mounted on its crown. The teeth nestled in the straw couldn't be seen. Was it really old enough to be Zapotec? That he couldn't tell. There was a huge irregular hole in the left side of the skull, involving parts of the frontal, parietal, occipital, and temporal bones. He was certain that this open defect, as it was called in the bland jargon of forensic science, was post-mortem. Bone was pretty much the same color through and through, so if it had been inflicted at the time of death, its edges would have been the same color as the rest of the skull. But the edges of this defect were distinctly paler than the rest of the skull, indicating that the bone had been exposed to the elements for some time before the break occurred, and the defect had nothing to do with the cause of death. He returned to the desk out front, where the man was now struggling with another set of copies, trying to get the dog-eared carbons to go around the roller. "Excuse me, you have a skull in the old dining room." "The Zapotec Princess," he said without looking up. "Yes, I wonder if it would be possible to take it out of the case. I'd like very much to have a closer look."
No. It's against the rules."
"It's not merely out of curiosity. I'm an anthropology professor."
"Rules are rules. If I let you break them, then I'd have to let everyone break them, wouldn't I? And then where would we all be? Where would it end?"
"I understand your point." The man looked up suddenly from his task.
"Unless, of course, you're interested in purchasing it."
Gideon stared at him. "It's for sale?"
"Not ordinarily, no, of course not. But you're an anthropologist, a professional person. That puts an entirely new cast on things, you see."
No, Gideon didn't see, but having gone to all this trouble, he did want to have a better look at the skull. "Yes, I see that. Well, yes, I might very well be interested in purchasing it."
"In that case," said Mr. Castellanos Jones, springing rabbit-like from his chair, "let us make haste. Time is money."
He grabbed a ring of keys from his desk, led Gideon to the case, and removed the skull with its saucer, laying them gently down on the only free corner of the ponderous, thick-legged dining table.
"What do you think?"
"Hard to say," Gideon said, rotating it to see all sides.
"I can let you have it for $100 American, which is a professional courtesy price, in that you are an anthropologist."
Gideon was absorbed in his examination. When it had been in its case, he hadn't been able to see the rear portion of the skull, but now he could, and he had revised his earlier opinion. The hole had been inflicted after death, yes, but in a way it probably was related to the cause of death. Extending onto the occipital bone, clear through the occipital bone, from the rearmost margin of the hole was a deep cleft, not a fracture, but a cleft, that had been hacked into the living bone. Ancient or modern, whoever this was had had his life ended by a wicked blow with something like an axe or a machete, and he guessed that the cleft had weakened the bone around it and possibly contributed to the later breakage.
"I see that the imperfection concerns you," Castellanos Jones said. "Yes, I had forgotten about that. Taking it into consideration, I can let you have it at a discount of, 25%? $75, all told?"
Gideon had turned it over and was now studying what was left of the teeth. They were in terrible shape, most of them rotted to nubbins, some to the size of corn kernels. That was probably what had led Dr. Ibarra, the medico legista, to declare that the skull was pre-Hispanic.
Nowadays, you only saw teeth like these in archaeological specimens, among people whose diets had consisted largely of stone-ground grains. Pulverizing corn between a mano and a metate, or between a stone mortar and pestle, also produced minute fragments of pulverized stone, and it was these fragments that could grind down tooth enamel, bringing on decay and gum disease, and turning the dentition into wreckage like this. Ibarra had been right, he decided. This was not a modern skull. There was no conceivable connection to Tony. Reluctantly, he concluded that it had all been a wild goose chase. Whatever the reason Tony had tried to kill him, it had nothing to do with this Zapotec princess.
I should probably mention, said Castellanos Jones, that several other parties, one of them a prominent educational institution, have shown interest in this specimen and may very well be gone by next week.
Well, yes, Gideon said, placing the skull back in its saucer. But I'm afraid I don't. He stopped in mid-sentence, his forehead wrinkled, the image of the rotted teeth still in his mind. Wait a minute.
Opportunity missed is opportunity lost, you know, and opportunity seldom knocks twice. Why, whatever's the matter? Are you all right, Professor?
Gideon was staring so hard, so fixedly at the skull, that he had alarmed Castellanos Jones. With staggering suddenness and mind-bending simplicity, everything had clicked into place. Why Blaze had been killed 30 years ago, why Manolo had been killed a few months ago, why he himself had damn near been killed yesterday. There were details missing, yes, but the overall picture had leapt into focus as crisply as if he'd turned the knob on a pair of binoculars. It was almost too crazy to be true, and yet...
Yes, I'm okay, Gideon said. Would a check be all right? I don't have $75 with me.
A check will be fine, he paused, smiling, with his hands neatly folded at his waist, like an old-fashioned department store floor walker. Would you like that wrapped?
An hour later, Gideon pulled up in the parking lot of the Hacienda Encantada. He had tried calling Marmalejo, but Corporal Vela had answered, telling him that the colonel was in Teotitlan, at the Hacienda Encantada. That suited Gideon perfectly, and it was with building excitement that he climbed out of the van, carefully cradling the skull. He had declined Castellanos Jones's offer to wrap it, in the palm of one hand, thumb lodged into the foramen magnum, the conveniently thumb-sized opening in the base for the entry of the spinal cord, and his other arm holding it protectively against his body the way a runner holds a football. He saw Marmalejo at once. He was sitting at one of the larger tables on the terrace with Jamie, Annie, Carl, and Julie. Spread out in front of them were mugs of coffee and plates of mid-afternoon pastries, torrones, sweet rolls and galletas, sugar anise and cinnamon cookies, the aromas of which made his mouth water.
I see Dorotea's back, he said, approaching the table.
Oh, yeah, Annie answered, back and happy as a clam. Well, as happy as she gets. She has no problem working for Josefa. She tilted her chin at the skull. Who's your friend?
Ah, my friend, yes, Gideon said. Well, that's an interesting story, but I don't want to interrupt.
There is nothing to interrupt, Marmalejo said. I was simply partaking of the generous hospitality offered. Our business for the day is finished. Unfortunately, I fear we've come no closer to enlightenment.
Oh, I think that with the help of my friend here, he patted the skull, I might be able to provide a little of that.
He pulled out a chair, sat, and set the skull on the table in front of him.
Ouch, Carl said, looking at the jagged hole in the side. Looks like somebody whacked him. Yes, with an axe or something like it.
Annie turned the skull to face her.
Alas, poor Yorick, I knew him well.
Gideon smiled. You'd be surprised.
Ooh, that sounds mysterious. What's it mean?
Julie was eyeing him.
You look awfully pleased with yourself.
Well, I think I have a surprise for you.
Oh, Lord, another surprise, Jamie said. I don't know if we can handle another surprise.
What is it, Gideon? Marmalejo asked.
Is that the skull from the museum?
That it is.
And is it an ancient Zapotec skull?
That it is not.
A couple of beats passed, and then Julie said, And are you planning to tell us what it is anytime soon?
Well?
With a sigh, Marmolejo addressed the others.
You see how we have to tease it out of him, how he lets it out one tantalizing morsel at a time. It's always this way. I believe he's doing it primarily for my benefit. Professor Oliver finds happiness in baffling the mind of this simple, hard-working policeman.
Hey, this is pretty grim stuff I do, Gideon said. I have to find happiness where I can.
Well, you better tell us pretty soon, Julie warned, or I guarantee you're not going to be happy very long.
Gideon laughed, but whatever they might think, he was not merely grandstanding, or at least not only grandstanding. What he had to tell them was going to knock them for a loop in any case, especially Annie, Jamie, and Carl. But he wanted to prepare them to present it in the right way, and not simply dump it in their laps.
Okay, he said, but first let me make sure I have my facts straight. Tony came back and took over the hacienda in 1979, is that right?
Right, Carl and Jamie said together, and then Carl added, But it wasn't the hacienda then. It was still a horse ranch.
Okay. And he would have been how old at the time? Mid-twenties somewhere?
25, said Jamie. He was born in 1954.
Fine. And when he left home as a kid, he was how old?
Somebody tell me what this has to do with the price of tea in China, Annie grumbled.
He was 16, Jamie said. I was 6 or 7.
So that was in 1970,
Jamie thought for a moment.
Yes. 69 or 70.
All right, that's what I thought. Let me get on with it then. God be praised, Marmolejo murmured, pleasantly enough.
The reason this skull was thought to be very old, Gideon said, was the condition of the teeth. He tipped it back for them to see the blackened, tarnished, cracked remnants of the dentition. Annie winced.
Yuck, it hurts just to look at that.
Believe me, it would have hurt more if you had them in your mouth. Now, until fairly recently, the only times you saw teeth like these were in people whose diet included a lot of stone-ground foods. So Dr. Ibarra, the local forensic examiner at the time, concluded reasonably enough that that's what it was.
But, said Carl.
Yes, but.
Nowadays, for the last few decades, there's been another likely explanation for something like this, especially if you find it in a young person, and this guy is fairly young, and that is an addiction to methamphetamine, which is what we've got here. One hell of a case of meth mouth.
Meth mouth, he explained, went along with heavy methamphetamine use. There was plenty of reasons for it. First, the caustic, acidic mix of the drug itself corroded tooth enamel and gum tissue. It also decreased the production of saliva, which made things even worse because saliva both neutralized acids and inhibited the growth of cavity-causing bacteria. Also, the resulting thirst that went along with dry mouth often resulted in the consumption of sugary drinks that did their own nasty damage. Add to that the near-constant teeth grinding that was part of the addiction. This was the reason that meth addicts were called tweakers, and the result was a toxic stew that could turn the teeth into horrors that looked just like what they had in front of them. Meth mouth.
Well, okay, but how can you be sure that's really what it is and not an ancient skull? Jamie asked. I mean, if they look the same.
Well, they don't look exactly the same, Gideon said. With meth mouth, you get a distinctive pattern of cavities that aren't related to ordinary wear. On the buccal sides of the teeth, for example, and also between the anterior.
I think I see where Gideon's going with this, Carl said, frowning down at his coffee mug.
The other night, remember? Tony was talking about how he used to have a pal who had a worse problem with meth than he did.
Huicho something, Jamie said.
And how they got into trouble, Carl continued. A whole lot of trouble was the way he put it.
He put a hand on the skull. Is this him, Hoicho? Is that where you're going?
No, it's not Hoicho, Gideon said. You're close, but not quite there. Look at the teeth again.
He held the skull completely upside down for them.
Count them.
14, Jamie said after a few seconds, and others murmured their agreement.
But if he had them all, there'd be 16, Julie said, and another 16 in the lower jaw.
Right. He's missing 2 teeth from his upper jaw. And if we had his mandible, I'd be guessing there were another 2 missing from that.
At that, an almost visible current of uneasiness passed around the table. They had some dawning sense of where he was going, but couldn't quite see it clearly yet. Or couldn't believe it.
Gideon, are you saying...
Julie said slowly, then gazed quizzically at him.
What are you saying?
The missing teeth are the 2nd premolars. They appear to be congenitally missing. This, as you know, is an extremely rare condition that happens to run in the Gallagher family. Blaze, Tony's sister, had it. Annie, Blaze's daughter, you have it. Jamie, Tony's brother, you have it. Only Tony, or rather the man you've been calling Tony for 30 years, didn't have it. But this man, he tapped the skull, he did.
For a long time they just sat there and stared at him, stared at the skull. None of them could bring themselves to say it, so finally Gideon said it for them.
This, he said, his hand resting on the skull, is Tony Gallagher.
No, that's impossible, Jamie said with a nervous little laugh. This is not Tony.
This is Tony, Gideon said.